Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. So how's your September going? Here in the desert, things are finally cooling down to the point where it's safe to walk out into the sunlight. You know, for 3 or 4 months here, this neck of the woods, or this neck of the yucca, I should say, folks who live here might as well be vampires, because stepping out into the sunlight runs the risk of making someone burst into flames. We're still in the 90s here, but what a difference that makes from 100 straight days of triple digits. Our thoughts, of course, are with our fellow citizens on the East Coast, the Carolinas in particular. Florence is far from finished in terms of causing damage and risk to life and property. 11 confirmed deaths in the most recent news report I read. Millions of people displaced, power outages, trees uprooted, and of course, armies of reporters all out there holding microphones, standing in the wind and rain. Anyway, we hope those of you who are listening tonight from that region are safe and dry and ready to get your minds off the weather for at least a few hours with us. By the way, before we get going, I wanted to say thanks again to my friend and colleague George Norrie and his producer Tom Danheiser. They invited me to be on the program as a guest earlier this week, which I'm sure might have seemed a little odd to some of you, but it was fun. I was on with Jeremy Corbell to talk about his new movie. Had a lot of fun. George was gracious and lively as always. And then Ian Punnett gave the film project a plug last night, so that's greatly appreciated. Tonight, we're ready to explore topics that are familiar to Coast listeners, but we're coming at them from different perspectives than the norm. In the first 2 hours, we explore some complicated questions about Bigfoot. Skeptics, of course, don't think there's anything to it. They say Sasquatch and Yeti are imaginary, they don't exist, and people who claim to see them are either crazy or mistaken. And then there are many who think that Bigfoot might be real, but it is an undiscovered ape-like species, kind of a wary and elusive missing link in the evolutionary chain. And there are a few investigators who've come to a far more unsettling conclusion, that the creatures are not only real, but are much more than flesh and blood apes that we haven't captured yet. Ron Moorhead is one of them. He's been hunting for clues about the big fella for more than 4 decades. He and his colleagues, friends, fellow hunters, have had multiple encounters and have managed to record what sounds like a language. Tonight, we'll hear the recordings and explore the possibilities of a quantum Bigfoot. That's minutes away. In the second half of the program tonight, UFO true believers. Now, just using that phrase, true believers, makes it sound like a put-down is coming. But that's how many people see the world of ufology. People are, curious. People who are curious about UFOs or ETs or say they've had a sighting, they're classified as true believers. And I'm using air quotes around those two words. Like the slogan from the X-Files, remember that? I want to believe, they want to believe, they want to believe. Journalist Mike DeMonte takes this generic assumption and puts it on its head. He's written the second book that's under a banner of punk rock and UFOs, the subtitle, as I mentioned, True Believers. And although Michael often writes about music and musicians, including punk artists, it's not really about punk music. He's focused his talents instead on the strange world of UFO beliefs. Proponents, champions, debunkers, rivalries, turf wars, media coverage. It's a cool book that demolishes many preconceptions we have about the subject. Looking forward to that conversation. Webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from news outlets around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Pretty cool stuff. Tonight's one story is about humans who say they are actually aliens. Aliens trapped temporarily in human form. It's from National Geographic, so the story kind of takes an anthropological slant. Also, a study about how to spot evil in your own life, the 9 traits that reveal evil intent in the people you know. a wild story from Africa about a guy who says ghosts are tormenting his family, stealing his stuff, tying up his kids at night, as well as the real life story that inspired the current scary movie, the one called The Nun that's in theaters now. And then my favorite story of the week, it's about fake buttons, buttons that we press that don't actually do anything, or if they do, we can't tell. You know, like the button you press when it says close the elevator door, it never seems to close that door. You always wonder about crosswalk buttons. Do they actually work? You know what I mean? It's a funny piece. That and more in Knapp's News. And while you're on the Coast website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is about 15 cents a day. You get access to a vast archive of previous programs, commercial free. You can listen anytime you want, on as often as you want, on just about any device. There are also other benefits that Coast Insider chats about once a month, and you can also learn while you're there how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which tackles many of the same topics we explore on this radio show. That also is a good deal. It's all there on the Coast website. Check it out. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat. Make a comfy spot for them at your side. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those silky jammies. Plop down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Ron Moorhead, Quantum Bigfoot, and his Bigfoot recordings. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I got a call a few weeks ago from someone who is well known to our listening audience here, Dave Politis. Dave these days is best known for his books, The Missing 411 series, but you might recall that before he launched that research, he was my guest on this program to talk about Bigfoot, Sasquatch. Dave had done years of work pursuing the legend and lore surrounding Bigfoot. And in all the years I've known him, I don't think he's ever recommended someone else to be interviewed on the show, but he could not speak highly enough about Ron Moorhead, an adventurer, hunter, scuba diver, author of two books about Bigfoot, including his most recent work, Quantum Bigfoot, which opens up a much broader view of the Sasquatch mystery than most investigators have been willing to tackle. Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, George. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, you come highly recommended. That's a good guy to have in your corner.
Well, that was a nice introduction. Yeah, I appreciate that.
So I know you were on the show once years ago, and so for those who have not heard your story, you've been chasing this for a long time because of an encounter, the first encounter you had. I'd like to hear the story of that encounter and then bring us up to date on subsequent encounters with whatever it is.
Sure. It started for me in 1971. I was part of a hunting group, and the original part of the hunting group started hunting there in 1958, actually. They've gone on now, but anyway, they had some strange noises coming into camp. Now, this is a wilderness camp 8 miles into a very remote area of the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and they heard these noises that sound like something never heard before. They're avid hunters, by the way, the Johnson brothers. And when they went out later and seen the size of this track, there's a huge track in the mud next to a stove that's been carried in there by mules earlier in the years. And anyway, they knew they were dealing with something that had a big foot and made some very unusual sounds. So they took off, came back later with recorders, and told us about the story, the rest of us. There's five of us involved all together. And so we all started going up there, and sure enough, these things continued to come around the camp after we get inside the shelter. The shelter is just kind of a makeshift beaver's nest looking thing with cables around it, which, by the way, it isn't there anymore. It burnt down this last fire in California, which is a shame, really. But
oh my God!
Anyway, the area is still there, and that's how it began for me. We went back up with recorders, and we started having the encounters that had come around. Very elusive. We underestimated their level of intelligence. They were rationing out, figuring out what we were doing when we were trying to rig up traps in the daytime. People wonder why you didn't get a picture if you recorded all these sounds of their vocalizations. And we tried, but we just, they outsmarted us, to be frank with you. They were one step ahead of us on it all. And now, after 40-some-odd years, 45, 46 years of talking to people and having more encounters, I've come to some different conclusions. They're a whole lot more than most people want to give them credit for. Most
Well,
people
we'll
want
get
to
into
think
that. All these
that.
trips that you're taking, are they mostly in the same area? Are you going to the same camp over and over on the assumption that they live right there?
They live somewhere around there, yeah, but they have a range that's super. I mean, I've talked to people that's seen these things, well, within just a mile or two of where our, not a mile or two, 3 or 4 miles from, as the crow flies anyway, from where our camp is. And, in fact, I just got a report from one here a week before last of a guy who saw one. He also saw something else with it, which was pretty unique. Very credible person. He's a firefighter. And he also seen a UFO for about 30 minutes in the daytime. So I think there's a definite connection there. I'm getting ahead of myself here, but.
Well, we are definitely going to explore that because, you know, I've done Bigfoot interviews over the years, and for a lot of really dedicated people, and I'm not putting them down and saying this, but a lot of dedicated folks who are trying to figure this out, they can't get their head around that it might be something other than just an undiscovered ape-like species. They just can't deal with it.
That's the issue I've run across is mostly professors and the people that I deal with in this field. They want to still put it in the classical realm of science, which is they want to think it's a remnant maybe of the Gigantopithecus, which was shown to be existent years and years ago. But they thought at the time that that creature was gone extinct, so they want to think that it crossed the land bridge and somehow is over here reproducing. But it was said to be 10 to 12 foot tall if it stood upright. So, but they don't have enough remains to get any reliable DNA out of it. So, anyway, that's what most scientists want to go with, and that's because that's the only proof out there, really, that the evidence that something huge has been here before.
Well,
Well, that.
I give them credit, scientists and those in academia who are at least willing to take the subject seriously enough to propose a theory or to look at what physical evidence there is, to be willing to go out in the woods and look around. I give them credit for that, but I can
I have,
understand why anything more exotic becomes risky for them.
Well, very risky. I give them credit too. I take my hat off to them. There's only a handful of them that will get out there and try to tell people these things might exist. And I speak with a couple of them, but they have a problem. They can't really get out of their classical parameters that they've got in their livelihood. They do, they're liable to lose their tenure at the school or something because they generally have day jobs, and this still seems to be the butt of jokes for a lot of people. But I think those people who disbelieve or don't believe just haven't researched it enough. I've been in it now since 71. I was 29 then, so I can do the math for the rest of it. But it's been a quite exciting thing listening to people and talking to people and interviewing. I've been into Russia, into Siberia, into Nepal, into South America a couple of times, and Bolivia and all that. So I've been investigating this for longer than most, I think, and I've been trying to put some dots together. But these vocalizations were recorded in the 1970s when they first was being encountered around our camp. We did have analyzed through the University of Wyoming, Al Berry. He was an investigative reporter that we took up in 1972, and he got real lucky one night. He set his mic up behind the shelter, remoted up there about 40 feet wired, actually, and this thing was really close to the mic, and he got some real clear recordings. We're all recording, and we've got hours of recordings, but these are the ones that I produced first on my first CD, and with his story of what he went through trying to get scientific studies on this, because it's hard to get any professor to take this seriously. But these things are out there, and what they are now is the subject of our conversation tonight.
Tell me this, your first sighting, was it a very brief kind of a glimpse, or did you get a good look at how big it was and how what it looked like?
It was a glimpse, and it was very fast, but it was also the very time that I recorded them, their vocalizations. So, and it was unique in the sense that it was, if you don't see what made the sound, you really don't know what made the sound. So, and people say, well, I heard a Bigfoot, but did you see it? No. Well, how do you know it was a Bigfoot? Well, because I never heard anything like that before. Well, it might have been, but you can't just say that unless you see what made the sound. You don't know what really made the sound. But this night I got to see what was making these sounds. And it was 3 years after it originally started. This was 1974. It was just a glimpse, but it was a long glimpse. I shouldn't say a glimpse. It was running from behind me where it made that samurai cry, which we'll hear later, and down into where the other two were. And it was just streaking through the trees at an inhuman speed.
So it was going to where the other two were, meaning you saw three of them? Or there were three of them there?
I just saw the one, but the other two were making their noise. This is a small one. We got the small one on recording, too. A small voice, and then a big voice coming down. We believe it to be a male, a male behind me, the big male, and then the female with an adolescent, where they're down below by the creek. And that's what this one was going towards, was them. I think he was disturbed maybe that these other two were getting too close to us, because they were around us that night.
The area we're talking about, I mean, where the Patterson-Gimlin film was recorded, a pretty famous piece of film, and I'm sure you had seen it before you had this encounter of your own. What were your thoughts about that? Were you a Bigfoot guy, or is just kind of mildly curious, or what?
You know, I actually lived in Fortuna up by Eureka, which is close to where Bluff Creek is, and I remember coming out in the papers, but really I wasn't a Bigfoot guy at all. None of us were. Nobody's up there looking for Bigfoot. They just happened to be coming around us, and why, we don't know to this day, other than maybe they were curious or trying to let us know something that don't know. But I wasn't a Bigfoot guy. I didn't know if the film was real or not. I didn't even give it too much thought at all after that. I think the paper said it was some large Indian gone wild or something up there like that. But I think all that's been established as being pretty true. I know Bob Gimlin pretty well, and I believe him.
He writes the foreword to this book, right?
Yeah, the film has been studied second, I think, only to the Kennedy assassination. I think it's just been thoroughly examined by professionals, and it's credible. It was a Bigfoot, and there's no monkey suit or zippers or anything like that going on. The Russians have established it and say that it is definitely a real creature walking through the woods.
Well, you know, people come out and try to their best to make that film clip go away. They discredit it. Oh, yeah, somebody admitted it was a hoax. Somebody in the family admits it's a hoax. Just to cloud the waters a little bit.
That's what it does, yeah, because, it was not a hoax. It just wasn't. I've been to that site four times. Not that that means anything, but the biggest thing is the credibility of Bob. He's just such a nice guy, and I see him quite regularly, and he's just he's a real cowboy, and he's not lying. I don't believe.
Tell me this: when you came back after your first encounter, did you tell people about it? Did you and your buddy, your hunting buddies, tell spouses, tell the newspaper, or did you keep it to yourselves?
No, we didn't. We were businessmen. I was a businessman in the Valley, San Joaquin Valley. And no, we didn't, because it was still the butt of jokes. You didn't want to lose credibility. I mean, I've been in the Rotary Club, Lions Club, you know, and I have a lot of employees at the time, and I didn't want people laughing at me. I told my family and close friends, but eventually the word gets out, and eventually you just say, well, what the heck, let's just tell. So then you started, Albury and I started going around talking about it years and years later. But he said, just don't mention the weird stuff that went on up here, because it's just too weird. And you start mentioning that, and you won't get anybody listening to you at all, because they'll think you're crazy.
Have attitudes changed up in that part of the country? I mean, you drive through there and you have different kinds of, you know, Bigfoot commercialization operations. People sell Bigfoot souvenirs. There'll be carved statues, things of that sort. It seems like attitudes may have changed, that it's been more, the idea that it might be real has been more embraced by the people who live there.
You know, George, you're right. A lot of people are coming out of the woods with this stuff, and a lot more people are seeing them, and yeah, there's statues you see up and down those passes in California, and even up here there's a fantastic statue out of 13 foot tall of a Bigfoot that this guy carved, and he gets a lot of people stopping by there. And when I speak at these conferences, there's hundreds of people that they're just coming out of the woodwork. Yeah, I had a sighting, I've seen this, and it's just incredible that the people's minds are starting to realize that maybe these things are really out there. I guarantee you they are out there. And it's not just they're out there, but what are they there for and what are they?
Well, we're going to find that out. In the next segment, we're going to hear a couple of clips of the recordings that you've made. We're talking with Ron Moorhead about his book, The Quantum Bigfoot. And when we come back, we will hear some of those recordings of a very strange creature making a lot of noise. We're talking with Ron Moorhead about The Quantum Bigfoot, his latest work after, I guess, close to half a century of pursuing the Bigfooted fella all over the world. It's known by different names. All over the planet, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, there are a lot of other names because it is not just limited to the Pacific Northwest, of course. People in many continents and cultures have seen these things dating back centuries, as long as people have been around. In a moment, we're going to hear some of these recordings, and I can tell you they are pretty weird. Stick around. We'll be right back. Ron Moorhead, you have shared in two books stories about adventures and expeditions out into the wilderness to sort of try and encounter and record, obtain evidence that Bigfoot is something that's real, that it's a real creature. And, you know, you're traveling with hunters. That's why you had the first encounters, because you were hunters out there in the forests. Any temptation by any members of your party to take a shot at these big things?
Well, actually, when they first began with this, there was pretty aggressive soundings they were making a beat on their chest and growl type sounds outside the shelter. We didn't know if it was going to come in the shelter at us. So, yeah, you're sitting there with your guns cocked, ready to shoot your way out if you have to. And but we didn't have to. And they didn't come in the shelter at us, but they kept coming around. So we, in retrospect, I kind of think maybe they were arguing with each other over the food. Maybe. Who knows? Until they can come in and tell us what they were doing. We don't know what they're doing. But they were sure, it was a little bit spooky to start with, but after a while it kind of calmed down, because it's like a dog barking at you but never bites. You realize that, that they're probably not going to hurt you. Of course, we always had guns with us, and that's puzzling to some people. Say, well, don't take guns in the forest with you. Well, no, I'm not going to go up there without guns. There's a lot of bear up there. It's 8 miles in the wilderness, on the closest road you can drive to. And it's just not smart to go up there without a gun. We had to shoot bear that was tearing up our camp one time. And another time we had to shoot a rattlesnake, 52-inch rattlesnake, on the trail. And those kind of things you need to protect yourself from. And what if something happens to one of the guys when they're out in the woods by themselves or something? You need protection. So I don't agree with the people that say don't take guns with you. It just.
What about the people who say they are specifically going out there to shoot a Bigfoot? I'm going to bag a Bigfoot. And
well, I don't want to say, I won't say good luck to them, because I don't think it's ever going to happen. These things know when you're coming. They're just too intuitive for these people that think they're going to go out there and bag a Bigfoot. They're way off base as far as I'm concerned. It's just not going to happen. You got that idea around you, they're going to see that in your aura anyway. Your energy is going to show that. We weren't up there shooting. We didn't even want to shoot at one, so unless we had to, and so it wasn't really part of what our agenda was. We just wanted to deal with them, and it wasn't until Al Berry went up there the year later that he started taking it to the next level of documenting everything, and he would. He was actually trying to find a hoax. He couldn't believe it, the way this was going on around us. And we just kind of having fun with it at the time, after we got through the initial fear factor, which that's a big factor. And anyway, it's, these people want to shoot one. I don't think they got a chance in hell, so to speak.
You mentioned, I forget in which of your two books, but I think you mentioned that some hunters claim to have shot a Bigfoot, and then they go to look for the body and they can't find it.
Well, Fred Beck did, 1924, southern Washington, Oregon. Mount St. Helens. Yeah, he claims he shot one. Him and some other miners, this is all a book written about that. He claims that he shot one point blank and it just fell off, and he went back to look for it, and the body wasn't around. But they were harassing the miners. The miners were didn't know what they were dealing with, but they were huge gorilla-like people. And he went back with a posse, actually, of 30 different men, I understand, looking for the body and looking for evidence, and they never did find it. And there's been several other people reported having shot them. One in California, not too far from where our camp is, actually, in Sierra Nevada Mountains. But who knows if he shot one or not. I mean, I tend to want to believe the guy, because he said he shot it point, like right in the side, and it just bled off into the bushes. But by the time they went back, it was 3 weeks later, there was a lot of snow on the ground. They never could really find what they were looking for.
I think it was in your first book, The Voices in the Wilderness, where you use a phrase to describe how it felt, that it felt like you were in the twilight zone. Is that just because it's a generally weird event, or because you got a strange twilight zone vibe, something beyond just a big unknown creature?
Something beyond just a big unknown creature. One night, Warren Johnson and myself were in the shelter. We were up there by ourselves, and we heard this this Bigfoot out behind one of the trees up there, which that's what they do. And we thought, well, we jump this after we realize they're probably not going to hurt us. So we came out of the shelter opening real quick and started walking up towards where the sound was. We thought we'd see it run off. This was a bright moonlight night, and 8,400 feet elevation is where the camp was. And on a moonlight night, you can read a newspaper up there. We thought sure we was going to see it run away. We started walking up towards that, and we both just got froze, I call it the Star Trek force field. You couldn't move forward, but he looked at me, and we weren't talking to each other about it. And I mentioned that to a scientist later on. He said, well, I don't want to hear about your fear. Well, it wasn't fear. It really wasn't. It was something else. And I had that happen to me one other time when I was walking through the forest hunting. We'd usually separate a couple hundred yards apart and work our way through the forest. So I don't know how to cause it. He suggested infrasound or pheromones. Well, at the time, I read up on pheromones, and someone spoke work within the same species. So I figured these aren't the same species, so it must be infrasound that stopped us. But now I found out that maybe they are part human. I believe them to be hybrids, and they have human DNA in the mitochondrial part. And that's what throws most scientists and physicists, because they think if they got human in them, the sample was contaminated, and that's where they go with it.
Well, Melba Ketchum has been my guest a couple of times on this program, and I've met with her several times before our results were published. We'll talk about that a little bit later, because I think she's got a raw deal. But let's listen to a couple of your recordings here. The first one is called Whistle, and we'll listen to the tape, and then you can tell us when and where it was recorded and what you think is going on in there. Yeah, Michael, if you would play the first one. So part of that sounded like birds, then it sounded like a gorilla, and then of course we hear, I don't know if that was you or one of your companions there who was trying to engage with it. So tell me when that recording was made and what the circumstance.
1972, and that was Warren Johnson, who was trying to interact and was interacting. He would whistle at them and you'd hear them whistle back, but they did the whistling, we found out through a study at the University of Wyoming. They do it through the vocal mechanism, through the vocal cavity. They don't whistle through their lips like we do. And you could hear the difference in that. But yeah, we were getting a little friendly with him at the time, trying to get him to let us know more about him. And so that's what that whistle interaction was.
So that's going back and forth. That's a conversation.
Yeah, well, in a way, yeah, if you hear these other ones, I got their definite conversation going on, which, by the way, it is a language. It's not up to subject or grabs anymore. Cryptolinguist from the Navy, retired as a cryptolinguist, which is unique. He's a two-time graduate of Defense Language Institute, has studied these also, and he says there is a definite complex language in this, in these sounds. And anyway, I didn't know a man like that existed. He looked us up in 2008 and wanted to listen to the context of the sounds and the sounds themselves in the original format. So he's claimed that. And something more recently has happened, which I think is very unique, and that's the guy called Thinker Thunker on YouTube looks through this. And he did a 20-minute analysis of this, and they can do five octaves in one note. They can reach five octaves in one note. Now, that's supposedly, according to him, that's impossible for a human to do or for any known animal on the face of this earth. I'm getting some more corroboration now from the scientific community on this to see just how it stands up. There's also Doug Hajek. He's did the Monster Quest series. He's got a man who is supposedly the world's or holds the world record for human range. He can go to infrasound and ultrasound too. So he's going to try to mimic these sounds. We've got a lot of stuff still going on, trying to get some more cooperation. And Doug will be bringing this out in a film he's producing. It's called the.
Well, we'll think about it.
Science
I want to
stuff.
listen to, I want to
Yeah.
listen to one more clip and then go back to the discussion of this crypto-linguistic guy that you mentioned in the book. So we'll hear the clip that's dubbed Anguish. I can imagine if you're out in the woods and you hear that in the pitch dark, it might make you a little nervous because I mean it's sounds very ape-like in times, and then it sounds like it's putting sentences together.
Yeah, these are ones that were made in 72. These ones that I sent you there. There's also that rapid fire one, which is definitely language, according to the cryptolinguist. But you got to wonder what was going on with this one, making those grunting sounds like that. You just don't know what he was doing. We didn't see him doing it, so you just know that the only evidence you got the next day is the sounds that you recorded and the tracks that they left. So we don't know what he was doing. I always tell people he might have been constipated, but it's not like it.
Is it do you have any cases where you have the recordings and you have footprints and you see it, or at least an outline of it?
Yeah, Larry Johnson, one of the guys up there, he was looking through the shelter one night when one walked by 15 feet outside the shelter. He saw it, and it left a 19-inch track. The next one, they measured it, and it was 8 to 10 foot tall. They measured with a stick the next day, so they knew from the background how tall it was. But as soon as he turned around to his uncle and I just whispered to him, the thing, he looked back and things looking straight at him, took one or two steps and just took off. So, caught one like that. They're very hard to see. These things are extremely stealthy. They've learned how to live in the woods, and you can't, it's like trying to nail jello to a wall to go out and find one. You just don't find them. They find you, is what I tell people. You got the right mind, the right attitude, they'll feel safe around you, probably, and come up to you. What they were doing with us, we just still don't know.
Yeah, but you're thinking there's a bunch of them around you, and they're interacting in one way. And then you mentioned in the book a couple of times you leave food out for them to sort of engage with them.
Yeah, we think that's what they were coming for. We leave food out for them. And like my last trip up there where I had an encounter, not my last trip, the last one where I had an encounter, was 2011, and I didn't leave food out. And this thing came around the stove out there tromping around and making noise, and it kind of frightened me a little bit because I didn't have a large weapon with me. I just had a pea shooter for snakes and the bears, you know, with a birdshot in it. And so I'm not sure. I other things went on that night. I talked about it in my Voices Wilderness book. But I didn't leave food out for it. I think that's what it was looking for. Now, in retrospect, because I was by myself, which you just ain't supposed to do, but I did. I had a guy scheduled up there with me, one of the members, his son, and he had to back out the last minute. So I decided I was going to go up myself, by myself. Earlier that year, our cryptolinguist and I, Scott Nelson, had been up there three times. Nothing happened that was definitive that we could really say, this is a Bigfoot. And you just don't say that unless you know, or unless you know it some way. I don't account for everything that I don't understand as being a Bigfoot. So anyway,
you know, The argument is, where are the bodies? Where are the bones? Why don't we have any of that stuff? A guy who goes out and says he shoots one, but he can't find any blood, he can't find the remains or any indication that he hit it. That's what troubles the scientists. If it was an actual blood, flesh and blood species, we should have some remains of it by now. How do you deal with that one?
Yeah, you think that. But the native lore is that they take care of their own. They bury their own, and if they live in caves or something like that, well, if they take care of their own, that's the answer right there. If they're interdimensional, then you got another whole other realm to consider there. You know, if they can move out of our perception of light and get into another dimension that we don't see.
Well, that leads us to the whole discussion about quantum Bigfoot, which we'll be doing in the next segment. I wanted to ask you before we get there about phonies in the field, people who fake stuff, who put something in the freezer and say that's the remains of a Bigfoot, or they, you know, try to dummy up an equivalent of the Patterson-Gimlin film of their own. Or, I mean, you've got them. I guess every paranormal field has got them, right?
Yeah, there's you can't have a fake dollar bill without having a real one somewhere. These things, yeah, there's a lot of people out there hoaxing things. Not a lot, but a few of them do. And you know, the truth in the pudding, if you're gonna get DNA out of it, so why even try that stuff if you know there's gonna be forensic looking at it? And believe me, there's enough professionals out there now tackling this thing, and they won't come forth with their names. I know who they are, but they're tackling this stuff seriously because they do believe there's something out there, but they want to see more proof. They want to see something besides, well, I think the sounds that I've recorded now is going to make a big difference with a lot of them. They've heard the sounds, but they just couldn't wrap their head around these things having a language. They want to put them in their box, make them come out to be what they think they should be, which is the missing link or Gigantopithecus or something like that. They can't believe that these things are what I'm saying they are, what I seem to, that's how I put the dots together anyway. They have some very unusual attributes, and some very unusual things happen when you're around them. Can happen.
We're going to get into that in the next segment. We're talking with Ron Moorhead about Quantum Bigfoot, his new book, and he's got recordings, got a couple of CDs of these sounds that are also available. We'll hear a couple of more clips of those and then get into some of the possible ideas about what these things could be beyond flesh and blood animals. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM in a moment.